Right. So welcome to the lecture on binary choice models and related. So to place this lecture in the context of the course, last time we talked about non-linear regression models, and we looked at two different ways to estimate nonlinear regression models. The nonlinear least squares estimator, which is generalization of OLS basically, and also the grid search models, which, as the name suggests, they search through the grid of parameters or combination of parameters, and they find the combination of parameters that maximize some norm of the fit, like R squared, or minimize the sum of squared residuals or such like. So we looked at the advantages and disadvantages of the two estimation approaches, and we also mentioned the third estimation approach to nonlinear regressions, which is based on the maximum likelihood approach. This is the most universal approach. You can estimate everything with maximum likelihood. So that's clearly a strength of this approach. There's also a weakness in this approach, as I will show you during the lecture. The maximum likelihood approach in general is the most efficient in terms of variance, but the weak point of the maximum likelihood approach is that it is, of all the approaches to parameter estimation in regression models and beyond regression models, of all the approaches to parameter estimation, the maximum likelihood approach is the most reliant on the distributional assumption. So you can estimate parameters of linear or nonlinear regression using least squares approach, regardless of the distribution of X and Y or the error term in the regression model. But if you want to do the same task using maximum likelihood, you have to make assumptions regarding the distribution. And that's an additional assumption, failure of which will immediately result in your estimates being inconsistent. So that's the price to pay for universality and efficiency of the maximum likelihood approach. So, okay, let's get going with the applications of this approach. We'll have this lecture and the lecture tomorrow on the applications of maximum likelihood to estimating nonlinear regression models. And there's a great variety of nonlinear regression models that you can estimate with maximum likelihood. So we have to start somewhere, and let us start with the simplest variety of nonlinear models that lend themselves to maximum likelihood estimation, and namely, this is binary choice models, logit and probit regressors that I'm sure you've come across earlier in your studies. So the logit and probit regressions emerge in the situations when what you observe is some measures, discrete measures of success or a failure of a certain action, right? And a person is employed or is not employed, right? So a project has succeeded or has not succeeded. A war has started or not started. A crisis has occurred or not occurred. So these kinds of situations. So there are two values. One indicates failure, however defined semantically in the context of the research problem, and the opposite is the success. Now, of course, you can generalize this setting to any number of discrete occurrences. So you can have success, you can have less success, you can have more failure, you can have less failure. So that would give you ordered probit or ordered logit regressions. Think of, for example, a running regressions with Likert scale variables on the left-hand side, right? So on the scale between 1 to 5, indicate your degree of satisfaction with the course, right? So, and let's regress the degree of satisfaction with the course on, I don't know, the student's previous knowledge of the of the material. So that would be your ordered logit or ordered probit regressor, regression, right? So that's one way of generalizing this setting. Another way of generalizing this setting is to talk about multinomial models. So when you have discrete categories, but they are not as closely related to each other. In other words, you cannot put them in any order. Think about the following examples. Which way of transportation do you use in commuting to work, right? So let's say you have survey data and you give people a menu of choices, you know, so how do you travel to work? Some people say, I walk, others say, I travel by bike. Yet others say, I travel by train, I travel by car. So the different means of transportation, you cannot order them from success to failure, from good to bad, right? There's no natural ordering in these alternatives in the menu that people choose from. So that would give you a setting that is referred to in econometrics as multinomial models. So you have binary models, which work with just two outcomes, but you can also have multinomial models, which work with more than two outcomes. Now, let's get back to the binary models, which is, as I said, the easiest case. So you could argue that, well, you don't really need, in this setting, you don't really need any nonlinearity because you can just estimate what's called the linear probability model. So you can regress the outcome, success or failure. You can regress this 0-1 variable on a linear combination of regressors, and that will give you the linear probability model, which is still widely used in the literature. Can you estimate it with OLS? Sure, you can estimate it with OLS. Will you get consistent results? Sure, you'll get consistent results. There are two problems though. The second of these problems affects the way you think about the consistency of your results. So let's start with the first one. So the first problem with a linear probability model, which motivates the nonlinear probability models such as Logit or Probit, is that if you estimate an LPM, you will definitely get heteroscedastic error terms. Why? Because, well, the error term in the linear probability model is by definition heteroscedastic. So you have to use heteroscedasticity adjustment. That's not a huge problem, right? You just add a robust option in stata and that's it. So that's not really a big problem. The bigger problem is problem number two on this slide, in that it could be that the linear prediction in the linear probability model, so this x times beta part, which is linear predictor, may not be restricted, does not have to lie between 0 and 1, right? So you are hoping to estimate the probability of a certain event taking place, right? The probability of y equal 1 conditional on the context, conditional on the characteristic of the observation that you are considering, right? So you want to predict how likely it is for the war to happen, or how likely it is that a person will be employed, or how likely it is that the project will succeed. Now, when you predict this probability with the linear function of regressors, there's nothing in the setting that will prevent predictions to be outside 1 or below 0. And that, of course, makes interpretation a bit tricky. And that, of course, also bears on consistency of the results, right? So I said you can estimate a linear probability model and get consistent results subject to the usual Gauss-Markov assumptions, especially Gauss-Markov assumption 3, of course. But the parameter estimates in the linear probability model are not consistent elsewhere. So one popular interpretation of the parameters of the linear probability model is that what they measure is they measure a local, not global, a local relationship between the likelihood of an event and the regressors that you think predicted, local to the average values of these regressors, right? So you can say something about the average Joe, right? So if you take an observation with average characteristics and change these characteristics a little bit, then in this local area, you will get consistent estimates of what happens to the likelihood of the event happening in response to small changes in the regressors of their average values. So, but you cannot make predictions that are reliable in general, because as I said, you could have situations in which the predictions are below zero or above one. So these are the two problems, and they motivated a different approach, a new approach to estimating binary choice models, and also multinomial choice models, order choice models, which are not suffering from these two problems. And the approach is called latent variable approach. So at the foundation of the latent variable approach is the latent variable model. So what is the latent variable model? Latent variable model says, well, let's say that behind the observations that we have in our data, there is a process that we don't observe. So hence the latent adjective. There is a process that we don't observe, and this process generates outcomes. Let's denote these outcomes Y star. Right, so for each observation that we have in our data, the latent process generates a latent outcome Y star that we do not observe. Now, what we do observe is that the choice, the outcome of that we do observe is one or zero. We do not, so in other words, we do not observe the latent outcome. We do not observe how much more utility employment brings to the worker relative to unemployment. We do not observe the benefits of war versus the costs of war. We do not observe the advantages of the project versus disadvantages of the project. What we do observe is whether a person is employed or not, whether a war started or not, or whether the project has succeeded or not, right? So, and now let's link these 0-1 events with the latent outcomes. And the latent variable model says, well, if the latent outcome for a given observation exceeds a certain threshold, then the event occurs. And if it stays below this threshold, then the event does not occur, right? So for the example of, well, I use three examples. For the example of a person being employed or not employed, right? So let's say you have data on people being employed or not after some training program offered to unemployed workers aimed at reskilling them or upskilling them. Now, suppose you've got, I don't know, refugee integration programs, for example, happening in Germany. Refugees get language classes, they get some training sessions teaching them skills, both professional as well as related to everyday life, that would make them more effective residents of their new country. And the question is, well, what's the likelihood of a participant of this program getting a job afterwards? Now, so you observe people who did and did not participate in the problem, in the program. Let's abstract from the Gauss-Markov issues. Let's say everything is exogenous and participation in the program is completely random. It isn't, but let's, for this example, agree on that. So then you would just compare the frequency of employment among the people who did and did not participate in the program, right? But the latent variable model will say, well, the participation in the program improves the fit of the person to the labor market, right? It improves the amount of human, it improves the human capital, if you want to use the term. It improves participation in the program, improves the amount of human capital that the person has, and people with high amounts of human capital find employment more easily than people with low amounts of human capital, right? So you would only be employed if your marginal product of labor is above the wage or at the wage, right? Your marginal product of labor is a function of your human capital. So the more human capital you've got, the more likely it is that you will be employed, right? And if you have a critical amount of human capital, then you get employed. If you have the amount of human capital below this critical amount, you do not get employed. Now, you don't observe the human capital, you observe the outcome. And the latent variable model says, well, let's suppose that if the level of human capital that you observe exceeds a certain threshold, then you have a one in your data. And if it falls below this threshold, then you have a zero in your data. Now, in equation 29, you see that the threshold is set to zero. And you might ask, well, why zero? Why not 10.7? And the answer is, well, if you look at equation 28, in equation 28, you have the outcome in the latent variable model modeled as a linear function of the x's plus the error term. And this linear function already has the constant term. What you have is the constant term in this regression already sucked in, already sucking in the numerical threshold in above which the event occurs and below which the event does not occur, right? So setting a threshold to zero is not arbitrary, but it is permissible if you have a constant term in the latent variable model. So that's okay. Now, when does the latent outcome exceed its critical value? Well, if the latent outcome is modeled as a linear function of x's plus the error term, the latent outcome exceeding its critical value can be rewritten in terms of the value of the error term specific to this particular observation I. So the outcome, the latent outcome will exceed its critical level if the error term in the model is below a certain value. Now, so that's just rearranging terms in the inequality, right? So there's nothing controversial here. And well, what is the probability of a random variable being at or below a certain value? Well, that's by definition the cumulative probability density function of the distribution that this random variable follows, right? So if we have a distribution of minus the error term in the latent variable model, then we can model this process and estimate the parameters of it, the betas, using the data that we actually have. Now, the advantage of this approach is that if we model not the linear but nonlinear function of x's, this is a nonlinear function, it's a cumulative probability density function, then by definition, we have the predictions being bound between zero and one. So you can make reliable predictions for not only for observations close to average, but also for the observations apart from the average, since the predicted values are bounded between zero and one. Now, the error term in this model is assumed to be homoschedastic. Where do you see this homoschedasticity assumption? Well, the homoschedasticity assumption is here because we think that all the error terms follow the same distribution with the same function, the same cumulative probability density function F. Now, obviously, if the error terms are heteroschedastic, they will not follow the same error terms from different observations will not follow the same probability density function because these the probability density the distributions that the error terms from different observations will follow will differ by their variance, right? So they will have different PDFs. But this homoschedasticity assumption can be tested and there are ways to address it as I will show you later in this lecture. So you can make different specifications for the F function, and the most popular ones are two, the logit and the probit. So in the probit model, you assume that the big F is normal And having made this assumption, you model the probability of the outcome conditional on X as the cumulative density function of the standard normal distribution. So that gives you what's called probit model. And if you assume that the error term in the latent variable model follows a logistic distribution, well, what's the CDF of the logistic distribution? This is the CDF of the logistic distribution just populated with linear functions of the characteristics of the observations. And you have the logistic CDF conditional on X's with which you model the data generating process the way you see it in the data. So as you can see, both logit and probit models are highly nonlinear in betas. You cannot estimate them with OLS. You can estimate them with NLS. You can. Should you? Well, some people say that's a valuable option. I would say also that this is valuable. I would say this is a valid option, right? So you can estimate probit and logit using nonlinear least squares estimate. The conventional approach, however, is maximum likelihood. Now, why? Well, maximum likelihood is just easier to work with, right? It's computationally easier and it's more amenable. It's easier to test hypothesis and carry out statistical inference procedures after the regression estimate. So that's the maximum likelihood is the conventional the conventional approach. But NLS is also valid and can be used. Now, so I assume that you have studied maximum likelihood estimation in your previous courses, dear students. But if not, there are slides that you can consult. So very briefly, the idea of the maximum likelihood approach is to estimate the parameters of the distribution that the actual observations in the data are assumed to follow. So whenever you set up a maximum likelihood estimation problem, you begin this problem with the assumption that you make on the distribution that the observations follow. Having made this assumption, you write down the likelihood function, you logarithmize it to make the procedure easier. And well, here's an example that shows the details of the procedure. So you can apply maximum likelihood to a single regression model. You can apply maximum likelihood estimator to a system of regressions, linear as well as nonlinear. So here's an application of maximum likelihood to the system. You can do statistical inference and hypothesis testing in much the same way as in the case of OLS. There's no Gauss Markov there. Well, there's a modified Gauss Markov along the lines of the Gauss Markov modified that we studied in the previous lecture. So, but as I said, I'm going to assume that you know the basics of maximum likelihood. If not, there are slides for you to refresh your knowledge. Hypothesis testing is available. So the likelihood ratio test, of course, is not universally reliable because the likelihood ratio test assumes that the errors are homoschedastic. Why does it make this assumption? Does it have to make this assumption? Well, it has to make this assumption because as long as we estimate the same set of parameters for all observations, we assume that the error terms in all observations follow the same distribution. That implies homoschedasticity. Let's run with this assumption for a little while and then see if we can generalize it. This is an example of the maximum likelihood estimation problem set for the binary choice model. So in the binary choice model, we model the probability of success conditional on the x's as a CDF of an assumed distribution. And we just populate it with the betas and estimate the betas. So how do we estimate the betas? Well, we write down the log likelihood And the general specification of the log likelihood in the case of binary choice model is it's the sum of the logarithms of the CDF in the event of success when y is one and the reciprocal of CDF when the event is failure. So you've got in the events of success, CDF, and in the events of failure, you've got one minus CDF. So here you've got minus epsilon below x beta, and so the success happens. Here in these observations, you've got minus epsilon above the x beta, therefore the opposite to success is happening, and you model the CDF for this particular, for these specific observations as its reciprocal. So everything is according to the definition. Now, this is, as I said, a general structure that you follow. Now, how can you generalize it to let's say ordered or multinomial cases? In a very obvious way, right? So let's think about ordered. How can you generalize it to the ordered Probit and Logit? Well, here you've got the generalization to ordered Probit or Logit. To do that, you notice, so let's get back to the initial formula. So here we say that a certain categorical outcome, let's say y equal 4, is observed when the outcome in the latent probability model is above a certain threshold below, but below a certain threshold above. Right. So therefore, this cumulative probability function will also will include an additional argument, namely the threshold, the two thresholds, the upper and lower thresholds between which the outcome of the latent process should be in order to generate y equals, for example. Right. So the thresholds will be different for y equal 3. For y equal 2, for y equal 17, etc. So the way to generalize the setting to ordered models is to include in this structure additional parameters which estimate the thresholds within which the cumulative density function of the error term should be for the latent variable model to deliver the outcome that will be classified in your data as a certain discrete value of y. So it's very easy to generalize it. Computationally, it's a little bit more involved. Of course, you estimate a bunch of additional parameters, but so be it. Now, so how do we solve for beta? The same way, we maximize the log likelihood. We take the first order condition. And when we take the first order condition from this log likelihood function, we get the following highly nonlinear function of beta. There's no explicit solution to it. There's no nice formula that you can write down and say, well, this is the formula for beta as a function of the observations. That's not the OLS, but so this system of equations has a solution, and this solution is obtained numerically for each individual coefficient beta. That's how you get these coefficients. You probably remember from studying maximum likelihood in the past that when you estimate regression coefficients from the maximum likelihood, you can also estimate the variance covariance matrix of regression coefficients, and that is called information matrix. In the maximum likelihood approach, the formula is here. So you can also get the variance covariance matrix of beta. Why do you need the variance covariance matrix of beta? You need it in order to make statistical inference, build confidence intervals, and test hypothesis. Now, a small but important note on the consistency of the maximum likelihood estimates. Maximum likelihood estimates are consistent only when two things happen. Well, actually one thing happens, this can happen or fail to happen in two different respects. So the assumption that is required to fulfill to be fulfilled when estimates are to be consistent is the correct specification of the expected value of the Y conditional on X. Now let's see here. First, the consistency rests on the correct specification for the probability density function of the distribution of the error term. You have to make the, you have to assume it, right? There's no way that you can get it from data because you don't observe the error term in the latent variable model for the same reason that you don't observe the latent outcome. So you have to make the assumption. You make this assumption wrongly, results will be inconsistent. It will be inconsistent. And the second part of this consistency assumption refers to the way X's enter in the expression for the linear for the probability of the event happening, right? So here we assume that X's enter in a linear way as a linear function of beta. But if that's not the case, if there are some non-linearities in this argument, then the consistency fails as well. Now, this is a serious limitation of the maximum likelihood approach that I think people have to reckon with in applying it empirically. So here's an example of the application of binary choice models. You can download the data, you can download the do file here. It comes from the Cameron Trivedi's textbook, which is, I believe, the background reading, one of the books that are background reading for this course. Download these, play around with them. So it's very easy. It's an example that in which we try to predict the likelihood of a person having medical insurance, private medical insurance, as a function of the characteristics of this person. So we got 3,206 people in the sample. They vary by wage, by household status, whether they are single or married. They also vary by income, by years of education. They vary by race, retirement status, and gender. So the data come from the United States. And this is a logit regression. A logit regression assumes that the error term in the latent variable model follows logistic distribution. Having made this assumption, we get the following coefficients. People of older age are less likely to have medical insurance, but that's not statistically significant. People with higher income are more likely to have medical insurance, private medical insurance, well, that makes sense. More educated people, married people, they're more likely to have medical insurance. The racial minorities are less likely to have medical insurance, retired people, yeah. So it broadly makes sense, right? So, but this is not an econometrics, this is not a health economics course, right? So this is an econometrics course. So we are more interested in the more technical aspects of this regression. But let us run the same regression with the same regressors, but using probit model. Just to remind you, probit model assumes that the error term in the latent variable model follows normal distribution. And what we get is by and large the same results, but the coefficients are different. Compare them, right? They are different. Household income used to be 2000, now it's 1000. Household status used to be 0.3, now it's 0.2. There's also changes in retirement status and the race. Now, and as you can see, the coefficients in the probit model are less in magnitude than the coefficients in the logit model. And that is to be expected. And that owes itself to the technical, some technical, not very interesting specificities of the probit and logit models. A more interesting question for us is, well, why are the results so sensitive to the choice of the distribution for the error term, assumed distribution of the error term in the latent variable model? And the answer to this question is that the binary choice models do not uniquely identify their regression coefficients. So there's a fundamental identifiability problem. What you're seeing are not uniquely identified coefficients. It's a bit like, you may recall, factor analysis, one of the topics we studied earlier in this course, right? So factor analysis results are not uniquely identified. Probit and logit regression results are not uniquely identified. Why so? Well, algebraically, it works like this. So remember the latent variable model. Our assumption was, well, if the latent variable exceeds a certain threshold, we have one in the data. And if it's below this threshold, we have zero in the data. The problem is, we don't know this threshold. We just model the latent variable as a linear function, including the constant term. And the constant term sucks in the threshold. So we don't know, when we don't know what the threshold is, we restrict the threshold to be zero, which is, as I explained earlier, permissible when you have a constant term in the original regression. However, the cost of this is that this inequality is equivalent to any linear transformation, any positive linear transformation of the original expression, right? So if x beta plus epsilon is greater than zero, this condition will also occur at other values of beta and epsilon. If you multiply the original values of beta and epsilon by a positive coefficient a. So in other words, it's not clear whether you're estimating the beta or some linear, positive linear function of the original beta. So given this fundamental non-identifiability of the regression parameters in the linear probability models, the question is, well, what are the coefficients that we see in the regression tables? And the answer to this question is that these coefficients are standardized. So the stata by default chooses these coefficients, chooses a single vector of coefficients out of an infinite number of possible vectors, such that the variance of the error term in the latent variable model is restricted to a certain constant. In case of probit, it's one. So we assume that the error term in the latent variable model follows a standard normal distribution, not just a normal distribution. And in case of the logit model, we standardize the error term in the logistic distribution. And in the standard version of the logistic distribution, the variance of the error term is equal to pi squared over 3. Right? So the approach to get regression parameter estimates in the binary and non-binary choice models is to restrict the variance of the error term in the latent variable model to be equal to some constant, right? In case of probit, it's 1. In case of logistic, it's pi over 3. Now, of course, this restriction doesn't make any economic sense, right? So because why would the variance in the latent variable model be equal to 1? Well, why not 17? And that invites the question, what is it that we are estimating? What is it that we are estimating? What is it that we get as estimation results? Well, what is it that we're estimating is some truncated version of the latent variable model. What we get as estimation results is a linear functions of the original variables in the latent variable model. So the original coefficients in the latent variable model are not identified. What is identified is the signs and proportions of the coefficients in the latent variable model. So to illustrate, if we have a coefficient on the years of education equal to 0.07 in the probit model, then it means that, well, it's positive, right? Positive. So what is it? Does it mean that the coefficient on the years of education in the latent variable is also equal to 0.07? No. What it does mean is that whatever the coefficient in the latent variable model is, it is positive. So what we learned from this result is that more educated people are more likely to buy medical insurance. That's what we learned. Now, another thing that we learned is, well, if you look at the coefficient on the married status, right, we see that married people are 0.33 more likely to have medical insurance. I'm not saying 33% more likely, by the way. We will talk about interpretation in a little while. So they are 0.33 more likely to have medical insurance, and only 0.07 more likely to have medical insurance with each additional year of education. So the marital status is about 5 times more important than an additional year of education for the likelihood of having a medical insurance. So the ratio is roughly 5. What we learn? We also learn that in the latent variable model, the ratio between the coefficients on the married and education is also the same, around 5. So we can say that a marital status is 5 times more important than an effect of the additional year of education on the likelihood of having medical insurance. So we learn a little bit, right? But we don't learn everything. And we definitely do not learn the coefficients in the latent variable model, the original coefficients, because of the threshold because the threshold is not identified. We were talking about non-identifiability of the coefficients in the binary choice models. So let us see what effects this what consequences this non-identifiability has for our ability to interpret regression coefficients, make predictions, build confidence intervals, test hypothesis, and such like. So let's see what the marginal effects mean in the context of nonlinear regression model. As I mentioned last time, the interpretation of regression coefficients in nonlinear models is not as straightforward as the interpretation of regression coefficients in linear models. In linear models, when you see a regression coefficient, you immediately see the marginal effect of the corresponding x on the outcome. This is not the interpretation in the nonlinear models. Why? Because in the nonlinear model, the effect of x on the outcome is a nonlinear function of not only the coefficient corresponding to a particular x, but also other coefficients and other observations. You see this expression? Because of the marginal effect here, is very, very complicated. So the marginal effect depends on the observation and it depends only on the other coefficients. So the question then is, how can you calculate the effect of X and Y using the regression output as the basis? And the quick answer to this question, well, you can do 2 things. Given that the marginal effect of x and y is a function of the x's, you can restrict the values of the x's for which you calculate the marginal effects. So you can calculate the marginal effects at particular values of x or over a particular range of the values of x. That will correspond to the specific marginal effect. More popular practice, though, is to calculate the average marginal effect. What is the average marginal effect? Well, the average marginal effect is the average of the marginal effects that are specific to every observation in your sample. So the average marginal effect is not the effect of X on the average person in your sample. The effect of a given X on the average person on your sample comes from this formula where you substitute X's with their mean values. What the average marginal effect says is that, well, if a given X increases by 1 unit for all people in your sample, then on average, the outcome will be determined by this formula. So for example here, right, when we calculate the marginal effects at mean values. So if we take, if we, these are the marginal effects calculated for average, for people with average, with sample average characteristics, we see that an average person, for a person of an average age in the sample, which is 67 years, will be a little bit less likely to have medical insurance if his or her age increases from 67 to 68 years of age, right? So if these, if you take 67 years old, year olds, and look at the difference in the likelihood of having a medical insurance between someone who has 12 years of education and someone who has 13 years of education, then this will be the difference in the likelihood of getting, of having medical insurance for them. You get the picture, right? So this, these are the marginal effects calculated for average individuals with average sample average characteristics. But if you want to calculate the average of the marginal effects of X's for all people in the sample, you have to calculate the average marginal effect using this formula. Well, it's not you, it's Stata or R or whatever the software program you're using. So, and that gives you different results. Well, not qualitatively different, but the quantitative values are different, right? So if you take, for example, if you have all people in your sample increasing their education by 1 year, then the average likelihood of having a medical insurance would go up by this 2.5%, right? So 2.5%. But if you calculate this for the average individual, then it's 2.7%, a slight difference, but still. So what is the most prominent difference? Well, in this case, there are no, the average margin effects and the margin effects for the average people, for the average person are very, very close to each other, but that doesn't have to be the case because as I said, the margin effects of X and Y vary from observation to observation. Yeah. So let's continue. Yeah, so we were talking about estimating average and margin effects. And as you can see, calculating margin effects involves formulas that are highly nonlinear in the regression coefficients. And that presents a problem. Now, you may recall lots of slides ago, you may recall our lecture on testing hypotheses and building confidence intervals in the context of a linear regression. So you may recall this small R matrix, big R matrix, these instruments for calculating, for making statistical inference on linear combinations of regression coefficients, right? So, how do you make statistical inference based on non-linear combinations of regression coefficients? Like, for example, how do you calculate the variance and confidence interval for this? Well, what you can see is highly non-linear function of a combination of regression coefficients. The solution to this technical problem is called delta method. And the delta method says, well, if you can establish a central limit theorem for your statistical estimate, then you can also establish a central limit theorem for a function of your statistical estimate, right? So if beta hat, if you can generate a central limit theorem for beta hat in the regression model, then you can also have a central limit theorem for a function g of beta hat in your regression model. So now betas in the regression model, they usually follow normal distribution subject to Gauss-Markov or its equivalent in the nonlinear case. So that means that the function, potentially nonlinear function G of regression coefficients also follows normal distribution. What are the parameters of this function G of regression coefficients? Well, the parameters are the mean of the function g of regression coefficients is equal to g taken at the mean. So And the variance of function g of regression coefficients is equal to the variance of the original regression coefficients times the square of the derivative of function g taken at the mean of these regression coefficients. So that's the delta method adjustment to the variance of the regression coefficients, which is implemented when you want to calculate the nonlinear function of the regression coefficients. So this is the delta method. As you can probably see, it relies on a second order Taylor series approximation of the function of regression coefficients g taken at the mean point of the argument, in this case, the value of the regression coefficient. So your first term in the approximation will be zero, and the second term in the approximation will be variance times this adjustment, right? So that's where it's coming from. Now, you don't have to do it manually. Of course, Stata calculates it for you, or R calculates it for you. In Stata, you have a very versatile commands margins and test and L that implement this delta method adjustment. Now, what else can you do with binary choice models? Well, you can calculate predicted probabilities. So let's say you're interested in predicting the likelihood of a certain event for a certain certain cases or a certain case, right? So you can very easily do that, because once you have assumed a certain CDF for the error term in your model, and once you've estimated the parameters of the CDF, you can just do the substitution and get your result. And the statistical inference on the predicted probability can be done either using delta method, which I explained just now, or you can also bootstrap to get the confidence intervals for predicted probabilities in the bootstrap method. I think we studied in the very beginning of the course. So these are the predicted probabilities of having medical insurance corresponding to each year of education. So you see that people with 8 years of education are this much likely to have a medical insurance. Now, because this predicted probability is an estimate function of the random value beta, it will have the mean and the confidence interval. The confidence interval is done using delta method or bootstrap. In this case, it is delta method. So that tells you the predicted probabilities at each level of education. And you see there's a gradient in the likelihood of having a medical insurance so that people who are more educated also are more likely to have a medical insurance. Now, another point I'd like to discuss in this lecture is testing the goodness of fit, testing how well the binary choice models fit the data. And there are several metrics. There is the pseudo R squared metric named McFadden pseudo R squared matrix after the famous econometrician Daniel McFadden, who came up with this measure. I tend to like this comparison between predicted probabilities and sample frequencies. So you get the actual frequency, you get the predicted probability, how well do they correspond with each other, right? And that is a measure called goodness of fit, which follows chi-square distribution with G minus 2 degrees of freedom, where G corresponds to the number of groups in which you calculate this goodness of fit. So I like this goodness of fit measure. I use it all the time when I run such models. But perhaps the easiest approach is to simply calculate the percentage of correctly predicted outcomes, right? So you can get the predicted probabilities, and if the predicted probability is above 50%, you can generate the variable predicted equal one. And if it's less than 50%, you generate the variable predicted equal zero. And then you compare your predicted outcomes with the actually observed outcomes and see how well your model describes the data. So these are the classification results. You have 3,206 observations. There are 3,206 people. Some of them have medical insurance, others not. So the people who have medical insurance are 1,241. They have medical insurance, and 1,965 people do not have medical insurance. Now, of the people, of the 1,221 people who actually have medical insurance in the data, the model predicts that 353 will have a medical insurance. Well, as you can see, that's not a very accurate prediction, right? So you've got an actual 1,241 people with insurance, but you predict for those guys, you predict only 353 to have a medical insurance. So in terms of predicting the probability of having a medical insurance, the model isn't really doing all that well. Now, the model does a lot better when it comes to predicting not having a medical insurance, right? So you've got 1,965 people who actually do not have a medical insurance. And for 1,652 of these people, the model correctly predicts that these guys will not have medical insurance. Right? So it does a lot better. Now you can see this. The share of people with a positive prediction in the people with actually for whom the outcome is actually positive. This is called sensitivity, and it's rather low. The specificity is the same for people who don't have medical insurance, and it is rather high. So there are other measures that you can calculate, but you can also calculate the total share of correctly classified people. So that's going to be the 353 who are correctly classified as having a medical insurance, plus 1,652 people who are correctly classified as not having a medical insurance. So that gives you what, 2,005, right? Then you divide it by the total number of people who are in your sample, and that gives you the ratio of 62.54%. This is the share of observations that are correctly classified as either having or not having a medical insurance. So that's a useful table to produce to see how well your model predicts the outcomes. Now, so the last thing I'll talk about in this lecture are specification issues and tests in the case of binary or multinomial choice models. Much of what I say holds for generalizations of the choice models. I already mentioned the issue of heteroscedasticity. Heteroscedasticity, come on, in the linear case, heteroscedasticity is probably the least of the problems that we should worry about, right? So we worry about endogeneity, we worry about clustered errors, we worry about the correctness of specification. Heteroscedasticity, come on, you just use the option robust and that takes care of it. Now, when you estimate the choice models, heteroscedasticity becomes a lot more of a problem. Why? Because if the error term is heteroscedastic, your assumption that all error terms in all observations follow the same distribution is by definition incorrect. So the usually modest problem of heteroscedasticity has much bigger implications for interpreting your regression results in case of nonlinear models, in this case choice models, as compared to the case of linear models. So how to deal with it? First of all, there are tests for the presence of heteroscedastic errors and other deviations of the actual model from its assumed form. And based on these tests, there are adjustments to the specification of the binary choice model. So let's have a look at the heteroscedasticity first. And then we will consider a situation in which we got the distribution of the error term in the binary model wrong. So the heteroscedastic case, remember what heteroscedasticity is by definition. Heteroscedasticity means that the variance of the error term is not constant across the observations. And a particular case of heteroscedasticity is when the variance of the error term is some function of the observations. Why it is specific is because the variance of the error term does not have to depend on observations. As long as it varies from observation to observation, it's already heteroscedastic. But if there is a relationship, then that's a specific case of heteroscedasticity that we will address in this part of the lecture. So in the linear model, you can do what's called a generalized least squares transformation. What you do is you just take the original equation divided by the square root of the function for the heteroscedasticity, and that gives you a homoscedastic equation because the variance of the error term in this equation is constant, right? So that's your GLS transformation. But in the nonlinear model, it doesn't work, because when you calculate the expected value of y as a function of x, it will be this function, and it's not equal to this function that you assume, right? So the assumption required for the consistency of the regression estimates in the nonlinear model case will not be satisfied with heteroscedastic errors. So there are several solutions to the problem of heteroscedastic errors. The first one is analogous to generalized least squares transformation. What we can do is we estimate the residual conditional variance function by introducing the new parameters in the regression, which significance can be tested with the likelihood ratio test. To do so, well, doing so is technically a bit cumbersome, but conceptually is very simple, right? So let's get back to the, for example, Probit model. So Probit model is a little bit easier to address the heteroscedasticity. So heteroscedastic probit is a little bit easier. So look, homoscedastic probit, in the homoscedastic probit, we assume that the probability of the positive outcome conditional X follows cumulative normal distribution. In this cumulative normal distribution, we assume the variance to be constant and to be equal to one. That gives us the coefficients one here and here. So here we should have the standard deviation, and here we should have the variance, and both are assumed to be equal to one in the homoscedastic case. Now, in the heteroscedastic case, when you assume that the variance of the error term is a function g of x, instead of one, you substitute this g of x here, and you put the square root of g of x here, right? So you can either program this manually in the likelihood function. Show you this. Yes. So this is logit, but you can do the same with product with probit. So as I said, either incorporate g of x here and here in the probit model, that will give you a probit model which fully incorporates residual heteroscedasticity parametrically modeled, or equivalently, you can use the ready command in Stata called hetprob, which does exactly the same. So there's hetprob, and there's also conditional logit heteroscedastic regressions. These commands are available in Stata. I don't know about R, but in Stata they are available and you can use them. Now, there are more sophisticated ways to deal with residual heteroscedasticity, and this involves using non-parametric estimators. There are several approaches. The idea for the non-parametric estimators is to, instead of specifying the precise formula for the cumulative density function of the error term, to try to approximate this locally using spline or kernel smoothing from the data. So that's a computationally intensive method. It's very much work in progress even now. In Stata, there's a command called DFBR, and in my experience, it doesn't work very well. But I'm just telling you that such work is going on. And if you want to explore the limits of binary choice models, and you are invited to check this part out. So that's how to deal with heteroscedasticity, which is surprisingly a big problem in the case of binary choice models. Now, the very last bit is dealing with non-standard distribution of the error term in the binary choice, multinomial choice models. So we assume a certain distribution for the error term and the latent error model. What if the distribution that we assume is different from the actual distribution? So in the case of probit model, you can generalize the normal distribution of the assumed normal distribution of the error term to a more generalized specification of it by allowing for squares and cubes of the threshold. Now, if the threshold is measured as a linear function of X, you just add the squares and cubes of linear combination of X's. Essentially, it's lots of X squared, lots of X cubes, and interactions between them. And use static commands to get these results, and use them in the probit model. Augment the probit model with the predicted probabilities. How do you get predicted probabilities? You first calculate the predictions from logit or probit models, get them squared and cubed, and add these predicted values at the second stage of the probit or logit model, and use the likelihood ratio test to test the significance of these additions. Now, the likelihood ratio test is permissible, but not the best procedure you can follow, obviously, because when you use estimated values of, as regressors, you have to use bootstrap, strictly speaking. But you know, there you can choose the method that you think is more expedient. I like to bootstrap things. So yeah, that's what I wanted to talk about in connection to the binary and multinomial choice models. For your information, next lecture will be about selection in the context of regression models. And we will be talking about censored truncated regressions and the two-part models in general. So thanks, see you next time.